This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today's episode number 78 of Feast Your Ears. It's a classically muggy July day here in New York City. And I have Nick Corby, who's the executive chef at Egg Shop here in New York. They have two locations currently, possibly more coming in the future. We'll see. Thanks so much, Nick, for coming down to the studio and joining us here. We've got great air conditioning here in the studio.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me, Harry. It's a cedar-smelling, air-conditioned bungalow.
Shipping container?
Yeah, shipping container, pizza bubble. It's a really nice little haven on this muggy July day.
Yeah. So Nick is also the author of Egg Shop, the cookbook, which just came out this year and is all about eggs. Not that eggs are specifically a breakfast food. It is something I want to talk a little bit about during the show today, though, about what you guys do at Egg Shop, because in the foreword of the book, your partners talk about how they found you to be the chef of this place that they kind of had this idea kind of floating around in the ether to open that would be a place that served eggs, but also had a full bar.
Oh, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about kind of the genesis of Egg Shop and how you became involved?
Sure. Living in New York finds people stumbling and mumbling and half dead and fully alive. And when they realize their position in life and in this city, they eat an egg sandwich. They eat an egg sandwich from a bodega, and it has American cheese. It's on a Kaiser roll. It has occasionally halal turkey bacon that gets passed off as real bacon or pork bacon.
Yeah.
And it is the best thing you can possibly shove in your face to cure what the city's offered you or taken away from you that day. So that was the rallying cry of Egg Shop, both for my partners and myself. We found each other through a friend, as sort of New York City restaurants and probably restaurants everywhere come together. Somebody has an idea, a waiter knows a guy, the guy loves the idea, and then somebody writes a killer business plan, finds money, and opens a store, and it either succeeds or fails. And we have been blessed for the last almost 3 years, two and change, to have succeeded. And around that notion that people love eggs and people love egg sandwiches, and that they eat them anytime, day or night, and it's sort of like an essential comfort food, apart from over-the-top cookery or silliness. It's
right.
Like, it's a pure ingredient that is comforting and relatable. Like a place that you could cruise into at 10 p.m., at 9 p.m. and go, you know what? I need an egg sandwich, and I need the best one I can get. And are you still serving Bloody Marys?
I mean, I think that is genius. a lot of my formative years in and around New York City, the bacon, egg, and cheese is like, that is the go-to on the way to work breakfast. I feel like everybody eats them, and your point about the halal turkey bacon is a very interesting one. Obviously, a lot of the bodegas here are run by people of the Muslim faith, and so they can't cook pork products. But I never think about having a bacon, egg, and cheese for dinner. Because it's just a, like, for me, it's always been a, like, you grab it on the way to the train kind of thing. But I do love eating eggs for dinner. I just never make a bacon, egg, and cheese. So I think that that's, like, the idea. And then the idea of having it with a cocktail, I think, is awesome. I mean, like, you know, I would never have a bacon, egg, and cheese at, like, 7 in the morning with, like, a tall boy of Budweiser. I know plenty of construction workers who do. Exactly. But that's not really my... It's not really my go-to in the morning. You grew up in Cincinnati.
I did.
Does Cincinnati have a thing like the bacon, egg, and cheese that is the quintessential egg dish?
I wouldn't say there's a quintessential egg dish, but there's a quintessential thing that people put eggs on in Cincinnati that has become a sandwich. And instead of a bacon, egg, and cheese, it's something called geta.
Okay. Yeah.
Goetta. Yeah. Geta. Geta egg and cheese is a thing in Cincinnati. At most local diners, it's a really interesting food product. It's like the German equivalent to a haggis, I guess.
Right.
It's pinhead oats and in a force meat that's mostly pork fat. So it's like an oat sausage that's salted and spiced. And there's like, you know, anywhere in Cincinnati, like, oh, what are you having for breakfast? Are you from Cincinnati? Yeah. Did you eat geta? And it's just one of those weird things.
Regional,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. So at other meals, the question for Cincinnati is about, you know, chili and spaghetti.
Of course.
But breakfast is always geta. And which geta do you like? And have you ever tried to make it?
I mean, I will say that, you know, eggs are, and I feel like a lot of, you know, for me anyway, when I was younger, when I was in college, when I was totally broke, I ate a lot of eggs because there was a lot of food there for the money. Yeah. And actually, you mentioned spaghetti. That was one of my, like, staple meals when I was in college. One of my staple dinners was spaghetti with 2 fried eggs on top and ketchup.
Okay.
All mixed together.
Wow. The eggs are the sustenance.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah, the eggs, ketchup has no...
The eggs are like...
No nutritive value in
the glamorous part. <You're> like, but I bought some fresh eggs.
Yeah, exactly. And a beer, and a cold beer. That was my go-to dinner for a long time.
When I was in college, I lived in Alphabet City and frequently didn't have any money. So my go-to that also involved an egg was the cheapest pack of tortillas you could find, the cheapest kind of cheese that would melt, a fried egg, and a beer that might still exist in Tallboy form called Orange-A-Boom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Never heard of that
one. Yeah, Orange-A-Boom. It was 99 cents.
Nice.
At C-Town.
Awesome. Yeah. The other egg dish that comes to my mind growing up in New York, actually, is what we used to call Leo eggs. Lox eggs and onions.
Okay. Yeah.
And kind of like tuna fish, you don't really need the extra egg in there. But and that to me was always like a diner staple in New York. I don't know if do you guys have that on the menu at Egg Shop?
We have sort of an homage to that in sandwich form that's called fish out of water. So it's smoked salmon, a pickled egg, and a pretty oniony caperberry mustard mix on rye, on seeded Jewish rye.
Do you ever eat eggs at home? Do you feel like you just cook enough of them all day, all the time, or do you eat them at home?
I do eat them at home. Like New Year's Day, I found myself making black-eyed peas, plenty of bacon and molasses and kale, and putting poached eggs on it. It's like poached eggs are sort of my Sunday home cooking food that my wife and I do. You know, go to the farmer's market, get the good stuff, and just put a poached egg on it and eat that in the morning.
You didn't start out as, like, a breakfast diner line cook or anything, and when your partners found you, you were not cooking. I mean, it was not in a breakfast setting. Can you talk a little bit about how you started cooking professionally and sort of what your trajectory was, you know, before you came to Egg Shop?
Sure. I began cooking because my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, told me to do it. I was producing.
That's good. She told you to do something, and you did it, and then you guys got married.
And now we got married. Yeah, exactly. And that's the life lesson. Yeah, like I like to start with the moral of the story, and then work back, and then I'll say it again at the end. So, I was living in Los Angeles. I had gone to school for acting and dramatic writing at NYU, and then moved to LA to produce a kids' TV show. I did that for about a year and a half. And it was, the production wing was out of Australia. So I found myself sitting in my boxer shorts, cooking myself elaborate breakfasts and meals while doing like telephone calls and, you know, having a day job that was mostly on the phone, mostly by myself.
So they weren't video calls.
No, thank God.
You were in your boxers.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that. Not even Australians. And they like to party. I was like home alone. And trying to figure out what to do with myself. And I had always loved to cook. And so in between these calls and while they were going on sometimes, I was buying wine and tasting it and making elaborate breakfasts for myself because my roommate worked in TV writing and had a 9-to-5. And so he was gone. So I was doing all this weird stuff at home and like maintaining phone calls made me super happy. Like loved it. And when I first met my wife, it was all I talked about. It was like, oh yeah, I made this and blah, blah, blah. It was delicious. And maybe you should try it. And I had so little to do other than talk on the phone. If I wasn't like, on a set or doing something, that she would come over and I would have this elaborate meal. Right. So eventually writer's strike, show gets canceled.
Sure.
Trying to figure out what to do with myself, really bummed out. And, Amanda, my wife says, you know, man, all you talk about is cooking and you're kind of good at it, but I bet you could get a lot better. Maybe you should go to cooking school and do this for a living now. So I did. The next day I called Cordon Bleu, now defunct, and signed up and went to cooking school. And it started about a month later. The very next day, I hit up my friend who was waiting at a place called Cafe Stella, which is a brasserie that's pretty cool. It's been around for, man, I'd say 15 years now or more. I have no idea what year it is or how old I am, but I think it's been around for 15 years. And that was my first job in cooking because my friend was a waiter there and got me in at the very, very, very bottom, cutting up cheese plates and putting them on a board. The first day I worked in a professional kitchen was about 2 days before Valentine's Day. It's the one time in the 2 years that I worked at this restaurant that they ever served oysters. And they had 400 covers on the books for Valentine's Day. And they all started with an oyster amuse-bouche that I had to pre-shuck the night before and grade on a small microplane all of the fresh horseradish for the next day. So my first day in the kitchen...
Gosh.
And I like had no real, I didn't know how to shuck an oyster. The chef showed me how.
And I was like, have at it, kid. Go for it.
Have fun with this pile. And here's
it's
some
like
horseradish.
Sisyphus, right?
Yeah, it was totally, it was crazy. And like a case of horseradish. Like I've never seen
And you had
fresh
to grate it by hand?
Grate it by hand.
And did you pass out?
I cried.
I mean, so, like, that stuff is intense.
It's Valentine's Day. It's ironic. I'm like, I'm weeping into a bucket of fresh horseradish. Like, my tears seasoned this so perfectly. My salty, salty boy tears. And
we won't
and
tell
just,
the Los Angeles Department of Health.
That's okay. That. They were, you know, that was before letter grades.
Yeah,
and, fine. You know, they loved it. People loved it. And just repeatedly, like, jabbing myself in the hand with an oyster knife.
And crying.
So I'm, like, bandaged and weeping. And there was something so messed up and so, like, thrilling about the ridiculousness of that I kept coming back and I stuck it out. And that's how I started cooking. So I was there for about 2 years and then, chased Amanda back to New York when she moved to New York. Never like, French trained, French brasserie first job. And then coincidentally, my first big job in New York at a very small place, involved shucking a lot of oysters. So I did that for 4 years at a place called Smith & Mills down in Tribeca that's still operating and is also like, I loved it because it was madness. It's one cook at a time behind a tiny cocktail bar, two hot plates and a toaster, making
a
full
menu,
lots of oysters, you know, doing it all.
Do you guys do oysters at Egg Shop?
Not yet, although I'm trying to work in probably the most complicated recipe in Egg Shop, the cookbook, which is a Hangtown fry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is my, like, making a Hangtown fry complicated with tamagoyaki and, like, tempura oysysters and all sorts of condiments that are difficult to make, so... I'm working on bringing that on.
So that's not one that someone, that's not a recipe someone should make for brunch, like, if they've never done it before.
That's
a recipe they should practice, you think?
Yeah.
In their boxers on the phone?
So. In their boxers on the phone, yeah. Calling somebody as far away as possible.
Great.
So they can never see you.
Yeah.
The tamagoyaki is obviously, like, the golden peak of egg cookery.
Totally.
And I wish I could say that I had mastered it. Not remotely even passable at it by any Japanese standard.
Do you own one of the rectangular pans?
I do, and it's such a beautiful thing that like you can hang on your wall, and people think you can do something with it. That's great.
Have you been to Japan?
I have not. I can't wait to go.
When you go, hit me up, and I can give you a lot of recommendations. There is a sushi restaurant in Tokyo called Sushi Co. where they make... they make the sweet tamago that you often get here in sushi restaurants on as sushi or as sashimi that's cut up, that's super like sweet and is not, you know, sort of like tamagoyaki, but it's made, it's almost like a cake, except that in Japan, traditionally, there are no ovens to bake it.
Mm-hmm.
So the youngest chef on the totem pole has to hold a grate of burning coals above the pan.
Oh, wow.
In order to broil it and cause it to rise and bake. And that was like the pinnacle of like a tamagoyaki style food.
Yeah.
And then of course there's great tamagoyaki at like izakayas there that you can be, you know, 10 beers and 4 shochus in and like wander into some place and order tamagoyaki at 2 o'clock in the morning. And like, it's exactly what you kind of need when you're wasted.
That's like the fantasy that I based this Hangtown fry recipe off of is going like, cool. I'm in an izakaya, but it happens to be north of San Francisco, you know? Get some Hog Islands or some Hamahamas, you know, some West Coast stuff and fry them. And
Do you base a lot of your recipes on fantasies?
I think so. I've never thought of it that way, but yeah, I think so. I base a lot of my recipes on fantasies and puns.
Nice.
Mostly puns. If I can think of a funny thing to call something, that is usually my way in to figuring out a flavor profile and some ingredients.
Cool. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio. And when we come back, I'm going to read an excerpt from How Not to Boil an Egg by M.F.K. Fisher. And Nick, I'd love for you to read a piece about quality ingredients out of your cookbook.
Excellent.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, and today I'm super excited that I have Nick Corby here from Egg Shop here in New York City. So I am going to read a excerpt from an essay by MFK Fisher entitled How Not to Boil an Egg. She writes, "The finest way, of course, to know that your egg is fresh is to own the hen that makes it. This scheme has many drawbacks, and I, for one, as a person who has never felt any bond of sympathy between myself and chickens, their heads are too small somehow for their stupid, scratching, omnivorous bodies, have always been content to let someone else tend to the henhouse, even if I had to pay much more for the product. Eggs are a good investment now and then, expensive or not, and unless you are told otherwise by your doctor, or hate them in any form, they should be eaten in place of meat occasionally. The old-fashioned idea that they are invalid food, something light and inconsequential, is fairly well proved foolish by the fact that two eggs are fully as nutritious as a juicy beefsteak, but 10 times as hard to digest unless they are cooked with great wisdom. Probably, the wisest way to treat an egg is not to cook it at all. An accomplished barfly will prove to you that a prairie oyster is one of the quickest pickups known to man, and whether you are hungover or merely tired, a raw egg beaten with a little milk or sherry can shortly make you feel much more able to cope with yourself. A biochemist once told me that every minute an egg is cooked makes it take 3 hours longer to digest. The thought of a stomach pumping and grinding and laboring for some 9 hours over an average 3-minute egg is wearisome, if true, and makes memories of picnics and deviled eggs seem haunting. The simplest way to eat an egg, if you refuse to swallow it raw, even in its fanciest, high-tasting disguises, is to boil it. Rather, it is not to boil it, for no more erroneous phrase ever existed than to boil an egg. There are several ways not to boil an egg, so that it will be tender, thoroughly cooked, and yet almost as easily digested as if it were raw. One fairly good one is to drop the egg gently into simmering water, first running cold water over it so that it will not crack, and then let it stand there in the gentle heat for whatever time you wish. It will cook just as fast as the water were hopping around in great bubbles, and it will be a better treated egg. The best way, I think, is to cover the egg with cold water in a little pan, heat briskly, and as soon as the water begins to bubble, the egg is done. It will be more tender than when started in hot water, which of course makes the part nearest the shell cook immediately instead of heating the whole thing gently. I've never yet seen an egg crack when started in cool water, but some people automatically make a pinhole in every egg they boil to prevent possible leaks and lesions and their inevitable losses. If you still want hard-boiled eggs after pondering the number of days it would take to digest them, start them in cold water, turn off the heat as soon as the water begins to bubble, and let the eggs stand until cold. They will be tender and comparatively free from nightmares." It's pretty good, right?
Yeah, it's fantastic, and that's why she was the best.
Yeah, her writing is incredible. And I love that towards the end of this segment, she actually describes it as a pinhole in every egg they boil, mm-hmm. even though she says that you shouldn't, boiling an egg is not a thing you do.
Don't do that.
She talks about how she would never keep chickens. Would you keep chickens?
Yeah, I sure would. I would definitely keep chickens. It's the only way to really eat incredibly fresh eggs that you can somehow manipulate Dan Barber style, the flavor profile of.
Sure. Yeah. I have a friend who's parents kept chickens growing up, and I have clear memories of eating those eggs once in a while when I would go over to their house, and they were so good. And I mean, those chickens, you know, they lived in a coop and they went out in the woods and then came back to the coop and they ate bugs and they ate whatever, but they also just ate all the scraps. I mean, they didn't really, I mean, they had a compost pile, but like most of the kitchen scraps, as long as it wasn't chicken or eggs and egg shells, because the chickens will, you know, they will cannibalize. But they just ate all of that, and I was like, what a great way to get rid of all your kitchen scraps and turn them into eggs.
Yeah, right. Definitely. Yeah, turning into eggs. It's like keeping, it's pretty different, but similar to goats, you know, keeping your property clean and kitchen scraps and goats eating anything. Chickens are.
My dad always threatened to get goats to keep the grass short because, you know, my mom wanted the grass mowed, and my dad said if God had wanted the grass short, he would have arranged for it, and then came to the realization that he did arrange for it with goats, but we never kept them. We never kept them at home. Do you serve a prairie oyster?
No, but I'm thinking about it now. It would be cool to do it with quail eggs.
That'd be great.
In, like, shot format.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, as a kid, I always loved quail egg sushi, where you'd get it, like, on the rice with the nori around it, and then the two quail eggs in there.
Yeah. Or even just the quail egg ikura, like...
Yeah.
Combination is pretty exceptional.
I mean, I have to say, reading this, I thought to myself, man, I mean, just an egg stirred with some sherry sounds so good.
Yeah. I mean, it's so antiquated, you know, like, especially on a day like today, like, I don't know if I really want to eat sherry raw eggs. Yeah, it's a billion degrees outside, and, you know, but there's an air-conditioned place that that's right for.
I mean, I'm kind of thinking about, I mean, I don't go out, I don't drink that much anymore, I have two kids, I don't have a lot of hangovers, but I'm thinking, next hangover, I think that is going to be the...
That's going to be the remedy or the cause?
I think the remedy. Okay. I think very little sherry to an egg. I'm not thinking, you know, I don't think like a glass of sherry with an egg in it.
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of thing. I mean, I guess you get into then talking, you could talk about, I mean, the show after ours is The Speakeasy, which is about drinks, so we could talk about flips and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, totally.
All of that.
Yeah, eggs and cocktails is a very, very interesting subject, and we get that question all the time, too. Yeah. And one of the more interesting suggestions I've gotten recently is about fining all of the juices with egg whites as a consommé.
Oh, sure.
So that we could be like, yeah, there's eggs in everything we do.
Right.
You know,
right.
Rather than just, flips and sours. And
I think the book is called The Apprentice, Jacques Pepin's memoir. He talks about, like, learning how to do that. But I think he has a story about, like, fucking it up when he was, like, 12, where, like, they told him to, like, do the consommé, and then everybody left the kitchen, where he was apprenticing, and, like, went to have lunch or something. And he, like, decided the raft floated to the top, and he stirred it back in or something.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
How do you feel about raw eggs as someone who works with them all the time? And you know, having, I mean, I, you know, the quail egg thing, I mean, I grew up as a kid. My dad worked for a Japanese company, so we had sushi a lot in the late 70s, early 80s when everybody was eating that stuff. Raw quail eggs never bothered me. Mm-hmm. I've traveled in Japan. I like to eat raw eggs with rice for breakfast. I think it's delicious. Never gotten sick, never had a problem with it. But in the United States, we have this, like, ingrained fear of raw eggs.
Yeah, there's a huge salmonella phobia.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you call it.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
But I think that one of the best things in egg life is runny eggs.
Yeah.
A fully cooked white or semi-cooked egg white, fine by me. But yeah, if you destroy a yolk by cooking it all the way, you're just missing out on life. Yeah. You're not preventing death. You're missing out on life.
That's a good way to look at it. And you're also setting yourself up, I think, for a not very great experience. And like, to me, opening up like a well cooked soft boiled egg is awesome. And then it's always like, I always think it's sort of like magic, right? Like my general method is similar to what she talks about. But what I usually do is I'll put eggs into cold water. And as soon as it starts to simmer, I'll turn it off and set a timer for 3 minutes. Because my kids like the white set, but I like the yolk runny, or, you know, a little bit runny sometimes. And I feel like it's like magic when you open it up.
Yeah.
And you just get like the yolk is perfect.
There's
you have a set white.
I think there's a very, very good reason that... whatever European chocolate company it is made Zakinda egg and put a toy in the middle. Yeah. It's like, that's the experience of a soft boiled egg, or like a well cooked boiled or slow cooked egg in the shell. You know, it's like, that's the thing. Like, that's why they put a toy in the middle. 'Cause the yolk is freaking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever grill eggs?
I have not grilled eggs as of yet. I'm starting to smoke eggs. For medicinal purposes.
Totally.
But I'm working
on big rolling papers for that.
Really big, really big. I'm working on smoking eggs, and playing around with that. And if I can do I want to do a cold smoked soft boiled egg.
Oh, wow.
For that effect, you know, a lot of like my cook and chef friends come to me and say stuff like, "Hey dude, where's your immersion circulator? Like, this would be way easier." And there's something like messed up about that to me. It's just like, like, no, man, like, just like crack them into some water, like poach them that way.
Right.
You know, like do it the way people have been doing it.
Right.
For centuries.
Yeah. It's just a technique you need to learn. Right.
Yeah.
It's not. And once you learn it, you know, it's like driving.
Right.
Right. Once you know how to drive.
Yeah.
You don't unlearn how to drive. I mean, maybe if you get senile, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can operate a car the same way you can operate a pot of boiling water and an egg.
Right.
But, you know, it's actually harder to operate. Like, putting machines in between people and food, especially in, like, an immediate cooking setting or a restaurant service setting, is a big mistake. That's what I think. I think the more simple you can make it, for the people cooking food, especially in a faster service setting, the better. You know, it's like... the last thing I want to hear about is, chef, this is broken.
Yeah.
Chef, I don't... This thing. It's
or
not me.
This is, you know? This is broken, and I don't. We need this to make the thing. It's there's like, no other way.
No, you don't.
It.
Here's right. some water. This yeah. is fire. Like, you know, if you can't cook eggs that way, there's something like really messed up about our culture and about you as a person in our culture. Just like, be a part of history.
Totally. Yeah. Would you read the piece on quality ingredients in your book? Because I think it touches on a point that I want to talk about our sort of where we've gone with our sort of obsession with ingredients, which is a good thing in many cases.
Yeah. So this is the first chapter of Egg Shop, the cookbook, quality ingredients. Let's get one thing straight: good ingredients make good food. We've made that a starting point at Egg Shop. And it can be far easier than you think to do it in your own cooking, too. In this chapter, we defined what good ingredients mean to us and how to go about sourcing them wherever you may live. It's one thing to hop, step, or jump onto one's New York City or SoCal pedestal and speak down to everyone about some such localistic esoterica as a curated selection of hand-foraged, single-origin, native species of pre-germinated, paleo-Babylonian, endosperm-only, tri-colored pasta that chef has prepared specifically for your party. It's another thing to talk about the human interactions that our current super-duper market culture deprives us of on the regular. We're after the latter, and it's simple. Go directly to the people who grow or make the thing you want to eat. Talk to them. Shake their hands. Ask them questions. Take their advice. That one ingredient you're after, that one thing that may be their entire life, do not disrespect. And you will be greeted in an edible Valhalla.
Thank you. That was great.
Oh, yeah, nice. Thank you.
Studio audience.
Many, many blessings upon you. Thank you.
I mean, I can't agree with you more about the fact that it is important to talk to people. And I think I would say in places where even it may not be possible to go directly to the person who's raising the chickens in the case of eggs that are producing the eggs, you could go directly to your grocer. And whether that person is the buyer in a chain grocery store like a Kroger or whether that's an independent grocery store, those are, in fact, people, as you point out.
Yeah.
And you can talk to them and you can say, hey, I really like these eggs, or hey, I had these eggs from this other supermarket and you don't carry them here, but this one's closer to my house. Can you bring them in? And those are people who are making those decisions. So, you know, the stuff doesn't just show up through a pipeline. I mean, someday Amazon, I'm sure, would like to just like have whatever, what's their digital assistant, Alexa or whatever it's called. Like, you could just be like, Alexa, I need some eggs. And they just like pop out of the thing.
But, right. Yeah. We're not, I mean, like even a big, bad supermarket, you know, it's not an automat.
Right.
You know, it's not a vending machine. There are people that work there.
Yeah.
There are people that care about the food that's on the shelf and, you know, have to look after it and all that stuff. And an interesting thing too is to see some of the things when neighborhoods change, when our little communities change, how a larger or a chain supermarket responds to that is very, very interesting. So even the Krogers, you know, in Cincinnati or C-town in a neighborhood in Brooklyn that becomes gentrified, that starts carrying organic food.
Yeah.
It's like,
or just that, I mean, and those places do adapt, right? I mean, I think our perception might be, and certainly people who are, you know, I mean, I'm committed to shopping often at the farmer's market. Our perception is that sometimes that these big corporations are bad. But, you know, we just opened a new location of the Brooklyn Kitchen in Industry City next to the Costco that's there. And that is the highest grossing Costco in the country.
Yeah.
It is the busiest Costco in the country. However, one of the things I find super interesting about it is that they have, you can buy a whole halal lamb in that Costco.
That's pretty cool.
And you can also buy giant packages of fermented Chinese sausages. And that is that Costco responding very directly as like the juggernaut of Costco to the constituency that lives and shops there. And I guarantee you that the Costco that's near my dad up in Westchester does not have a whole halal lamb or giant packages of Chinese fermented sausage.
No, of course not. And that's cool. These stores are run by people.
Yeah.
And they want to make money and they want to sell people what they want. So you just have to ask for what you want and know what you want. Knowing what you want, knowing how to start, is sort of the basis of Egg Shop, the cookbook, of my cooking. It's like, there's no way to get anything great out of your cooking unless you know what you want in the end.
Yep.
And how to start.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what quality ingredients and finding them is about.
So we're just about out of time, but I wanted to mention that you can find more information online at eggshopnyc.com. You can follow Nick on Instagram, Nick Corby. That's it. Very simple. At Nick Corby. Do you have anything else you want to mention about the locations, Soho and Williamsburg? Or are the menus different in the two locations?
Yeah, the menus are slightly different. Williamsburg just opened up on North 8th Street between Bedford and Barry. The heart of Williamsburg, open 7 days a week, and the menus are different in that the Williamsburg one features the most fantastic egg burritos and egg tacos you could possibly find, and they're not quite a thing yet in New York. That's a California thing that is popping up and going strong, and we have a huge bar with the most delicious frosé. That's all I'm thinking about right now. Oh, nice. On this 95 degree day.
All right. And what time do you open?
We open at 8 a.m. every day.
Great. So 8:05 tomorrow, I can get a frosé and a burrito.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. That's a good pairing.
Yeah.
I mean, frosé and a SoCal burrito.
Start my long Thursday of a lot of work off, right? You know, kind of yeah. Numbing, right? Just like, but the day probably would be great. I probably won't remember most of it.
At my age, I start my day with an Advil or two. You know, I think of it about the same way.
I mean, I feel like by 8 o'clock, I don't know. I usually get up around 6, start with some espresso before my kids are up. So I feel like by 8, I mean, you know, who knows? If I got a lot done before my kids woke up, I'd be ready. It might be cocktail hour.
You know? There you go.
Might be ready for it. So if you want the burrito and you are in Soho, you're going to have to settle for some other delicious egg dish. What's your best-selling thing on the menu in Soho?
It is our bacon, egg, and cheese, our Egg Shop BEC. Sweet and savory tomato jam, Vermont white cheddar, Applewood smoked or Black Forest bacon, sunny up egg with the yolk broken into the roll. It's what's up.
Sounds delicious. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tatasciore, who engineers this show. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes, and feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. Have to make a shameless plug here for my first book, which comes out August 1st. Vinegar Revival is a guide to making and using vinegar at home. You can pre-order it at vinegarrevival.com on Amazon or from your local bookstore. And I just want to also remind everyone who is listening that this show would not be possible without member donations to Heritage Radio. The generosity of HRN members makes this show and the other 34 weekly shows we produce in the studio possible. And I would love it if you would become a member, either with a one-time donation or a monthly sustaining member. You can go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate. And let's keep food radio on the airwaves. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next week.
For listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.